Hey guys, Matt here. Before we begin this episode of Anthology, I just want to mention that we are currently running a contest where you can win a free Anthology t-shirt. The contest runs from now until January 1st, 2018. If you want to enter, all you have to do is leave a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes or on Stitcher, take a screenshot of the review, and email it to matt@obsessiveviewer.com with the subject line Anthology t-shirt contest. On January 1st, I'll randomly select a winner from the entries, and we'll get a free t-shirt mailed to them. We'll be accepting entries until December 31st at midnight, so make sure you get the email in before then. Thank you guys for listening, and enjoy this episode of Anthology.
You're traveling through another podcast. A podcast not only of reviewing and discussing, but of discovery. A journey into a wondrous show whose boundaries are that of imagination. That's the RSS feed up ahead. Your next stop, Anthology.
Hello and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. If this is your first time listening, Anthology is one man's examination of The Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I review one episode of Rod Serling's iconic series and round out the show with a bonus review of a movie or show related to the week's main topic. I also cover modern anthology science fiction shows such as Black Mirror, Dimension 404, and the upcoming Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams in bonus episode review series. You can find more of Anthology as well as a full episode archive at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, tweet me at @OVAnthologyPod, or send an email to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. And today on the podcast, I will be discussing a most unusual camera. It's the 10th episode of The Twilight Zone's second season, and it originally aired on... I didn't put it in my notes. December 16th, 1960. And for this week's bonus review, I'll share my thoughts on a 2014 independent science fiction film by Bradley King titled Time Lapse. And just right off the top, I do know that last week I said that I was going to be reviewing Visit to a Small Planet. And that was because it also featured an actor from this episode of The Twilight Zone. But after seeing A Most Unusual Camera and knowing that the movie Time Lapse was on my radar for a long time and had a very, very similar premise, I couldn't pass up switching the bonus review. So hopefully that didn't cause any problems. But before I get to the main topic and the main episode and everything, I do have a few things to go over. It's been a very busy week, and you'll see why here in a moment, because a lot of news has broken over the last week. But first, I want to give a little bit of feedback or read a little bit of feedback from last week's episode, in which I reviewed The Trouble with Templeton, and my bonus review was a special Patreon bonus review of 2007 Sunshine by Danny Boyle. So, first up, Monica writes, "Hi, I was so excited to listen to your latest review because it is one of my favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone." She's referring to The Trouble with Templeton. "I was surprised you didn't like it, and even more surprised you didn't mention the best scene of the whole episode, when Booth leaves and the room stops and gets quiet and the looks on their faces as the lights dim. It gave me chills the first time I saw it. It's such a sad episode. Since you highly recommended the Tom Elliott podcast," which is the Twilight Zone podcast by Tom Elliott, "I listened to his review and was happy to hear that I'm not crazy, as he was right on with his review of the episode." And Tom Elliott, man, he's phenomenal. And I also listened to his review after that, and it made me, I wouldn't say that it made me reconsider my thoughts on it, but it made me kind of conscious of the kind of bigger themes of The Trouble with Templeton. And I kind of came away from it thinking, you know, I'm still a fairly young person, I would hope. I'm like 31. So I kind of wonder if maybe, I wouldn't necessarily say maybe it's a fault of my own, but maybe it's because I don't have that life experience that Booth Templeton does. And I kind of still feel like, you know, my best years are ahead of me. I kind of wonder if that is why I couldn't connect too closely to the episode, and maybe with a little more life experience, I'll resonate with me more, in like a decade or so. So it was an interesting episode. I won't fault that. In the scene that Monica's referring to, yeah, I did have that in my notes and I forgot to mention it, but it was a very eerie scene. Like it definitely left an impression on me. It was well executed. I just at the time I was so confused and catching up with what was going on in the episode that I was just kind of, it wasn't as effective as it was on subsequent viewings. And then Monica goes on to write, "I was also pretty surprised that you liked the lateness of the hour as much as you did, as I always thought it was just okay. And I can never not laugh when Jaina is doing her no pain thing on the stairs. Anyway, just thought I'd give my thoughts. Thanks for posting the Black Mirror release date. I can't wait." And you know, it is a little cheesy the way that Jaina says, "No pain, no pain," and like hits herself. Like, and yeah, it is cheesy, a little over the top, but just there's something about the way that she delivers the line that you can kind of read it as over the top, which it kind of is, but also just the emotion in it. I still kind of latched onto that. Moving on, another piece of feedback from Robert, a Patreon subscriber that suggested the review of Sunshine last week. Robert writes, "I really enjoyed your review of Sunshine, covered all of the things I love about the film, and even made me think about stuff I never thought of. For instance, it was science versus religion. What a great underrated film, great score, great cast, and great visuals for such a low-budget movie." And then he goes on to say that he has one minor criticism about it, but I don't really want to say it because it gives away some stuff about the movie. But suffice it to say, I did respond to him, and we've been emailing back and forth about it and his pick for next month, which sounds really interesting. I'm pretty excited about that. So anyway, he said in regards with his criticism, he said, "You probably realized the review was running long and wanted to wrap it up, so no worries. Seriously, I could have talked about Sunshine for another hour." And then he finishes up by saying, look forward to hearing you review some of my other favorite things. Keep up the great work." So thank you so much, Robert, for emailing me, and thank you, Monica, for messaging me on the Facebook page, and thank you guys for listening and everything. And I really appreciate the feedback. Seriously, I love getting emails about the podcast. It's really fantastic. I think I've mentioned it before, but like when I started Obsessive Viewer with Tiny 4.5 years ago, like we didn't get as much feedback or anything, or we never really got emails or anything. But then as soon as I started Anthology, since it's a niche topic and everything, I've been getting emails each week and everything. It's so gratifying to get an email about the podcast, because that's what podcasting is for me, is an outlet for my passions and to have a dialogue with people. And then also, since it's a solo podcast, I kind of crave that kind of feedback. So feel free to email me or message me and tweet me and everything, which, by the way, follow me on Twitter @OVAnthologyPod. So, moving on, before I get to last thing, before I get to the review and everything, on Wednesday of this week, I believe, which was the 20, on December 6th, I believe it was December 6th, is when kind of news broke about a couple big things. So first of all, I just want to mention that the Twilight Zone reboot from Jordan Peele's production company has officially been greenlit by CBS for CBS All Access. Now, what that means is that essentially a couple weeks ago when I talked about the news that broke about it, basically what had happened then was that Les Moonves had mentioned it in an earnings call with the investors for CBS. So he had mentioned it kind of casually, saying that they're going to be rebooting The Twilight Zone for CBS All Access. So now this news that came out Wednesday is that they have officially announced that they are ordering it to series, which means that they're going to give it a season of television on CBS All Access, and it has officially been greenlit and ready to go. So now, obviously, it's probably not going to be... I would just assume that it would be a very long, how to phrase it? It would be a very optimistic thing to think that we would get the new Twilight Zone in 2018. I would really guess that it would probably be early 2019. They haven't announced anything about when, but this is essentially they're ordering it. So now they've got to hire everyone and go into production and everything and then all that. So that is crazy exciting because I started this podcast two and a half years ago. I don't even remember. Kind of on a whim. In the lead up to it, I had been toying with it for a long time. I would make notes in my phone just saying like, oh, this is an angle I could do with the Twilight Zone podcast since I've never watched the show. And then it kind of just grew into what the podcast is now. At that time, I had no idea that we were going to have so much science fiction anthology television to play with. At the time, I don't think I considered doing a Black Mirror bonus review series. And then when I did that, I was so excited about the Netflix season of Black Mirror that I just was like, I'm just going to review it on anthology. And then I have Dimension 404 and Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams. And then now the new Twilight Zone. It's like, this is crazy. And I'm so excited to have a platform to kind of go through all of this media and discuss it and review it. And so anyway, going back to the news about the Twilight Zone, Jordan Peele, in a statement said that, quote, too many times this year, it's felt we were living in a Twilight Zone, and I can't think of a better moment to reintroduce it to modern audiences. And yeah, first of all, I agree with that. It's been just a crazy year, couple of years, really. And I'm really excited to see what he and his team and what everyone involved with the show is going to do with it. Because I think that if they do it right, there is a way to recapture at least a portion of the magic that Serling had in between 1959 and 1964. And I think that there is a very real chance that this could be a very good adaptation and a very good reboot. Obviously, it could also be a disaster. There's really no telling at this point, but I'm optimistic because we need more commentary on crazy things in the world. And Black Mirror, while it does have this propulsion to it that our culture has said like, oh, this is like the new Twilight Zone, and it is to an extent, but Black Mirror is kind of more geared toward the technology side of it, our kind of dependency on technology and how it affects our emotions and how we interact with people and our society and everything. To have a more exact reboot of the Twilight Zone, that could be a more like an all-encompassing thing about our culture and about the state of the world and everything without having to rely on like, oh, phones, but worse, or phones, but crazy, or whatever the phrase is for Black Mirror. But anyway, final thing about the Twilight Zone reboot is that someone on Reddit had said that it needs to be black and white, like it needs to be shot in black and white, because that's the one thing that people who have remade Twilight Zone in the past don't really get, is that so much of the magic of the original series was that it was in black and white because of the time, and if they want to recapture it, the best way to do that would be to film it in black and white. I mean, that's kind of a general thing. I mean, it's possible, but I think it would be cool to have it be shot in black and white. It would be a very interesting artistic choice. I don't know if it would. Above all else, I think the content is what needs to speak for it. The scripts need to be like very well realized and everything, rather than just an aesthetic piece of cinematography to recapture it. So anyway, I'll be talking more about that as news unravels about it in the coming months or however long. And I look forward to having even more stuff to talk about on Anthology. And then final piece of news is that I mentioned this last week, that Black Mirror has been doing their 13 days of Black Mirror promotion thing, and they finally released announced the release date for season 4. So season 4 is officially going to drop on Netflix globally on December 29th, and I am so excited, and I am going to hope to get as much recording done ahead of that so that I can double up and do bonus review series, because in the back of my head, with the Dimension 404 reviews, it's like that took months, and now I have Black Mirror coming out in 3 weeks, and then a couple of weeks after that I have Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams. So it's going to be a crazy busy few months here on Anthology, and I really, really hope that I can catch up with it, or I can stay current with it. But knowing my track record, there could be some lulls here and there. But anyway, I'm going to try my best. I did actually contact Netflix's like media services and also Amazon Prime's just to say like, hey, I have this podcast. Can I get screeners of Black Mirror and Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams just so I can release it in a timely fashion. So I did that last night on a whim. Who knows if I'll get any response, because I'm just a small podcast. So who knows if they'll take me seriously. So that does it for news and feedback and all that. That was a lot, but it's been a big week, and I appreciate your patience on that. So let's get into A Most Unusual Camera. And I'm going to start out, as I usually do, by reading a plot description, courtesy of Twilight Zone, Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic by Martin Grahams Jr. And of course, all of the review and plot description, everything, that is going to be completely spoiler-filled. So you will be spoiled on A Most Unusual Camera. So if you haven't watched it yet, go back and check it out, and then come back and listen to the review. So, all right. So having said that, here is the plot description, according to Twilight Zone, Unlocking the Door to a Television Classic. After taking inventory of a recent loot from a victimized curio shop, three small-time heisters find themselves in possession of a funky-looking camera. A short time later, Chester realizes why the original owners never reported the camera among the list of stolen possessions. The camera is unique because it takes pictures of the near future. Hours later, Chester, Paula, and Woodward use the camera to take pictures of the winning board of the racetrack and place bets of the soon-to-be winning horse. By the end of the day, the crooks find themselves with more money than they would have earned heisting mom-and-pop shops. When the French inscription on the camera is deciphered as 10 to a customer, the small-town crooks start to panic because they already used up 8 photos. During a struggle over deciding what to do with the remaining pictures, Woodward and Chester waste another photo. Fighting over their mistake, they fall out the window to their deaths. A blackmailing French waiter at the hotel begins stealing the money from Paula, only to plunge to his death out the same window, as does Paula as predicted on the final photograph. And first of all, the actual inscription says 10 to an owner, but that's neither here nor there. So starring in this episode as Chester Dietrich is Fred Clark. And this was his only episode, The Twilight Zone, and his only collaboration with Rod Serling. He had served as a Navy pilot in 1942, but later joined the Army and spent nearly 2 years with the Third Army in Europe, which I think was, under George Patton. I believe so. And then he got this role in The Twilight Zone after just a chance meeting with Serling at a restaurant one afternoon. So that's kind of interesting. And Jean Carson plays Paula Dietrich. This is her only Twilight Zone and only Serling collaboration. And she had never really aspired to be a leading lady, just citing her strange voice. And she was perfectly okay with being a quote, second tomato, because she could work regularly. Okay, my cat is kind of crawling all on me. Hi, honey. Okay, my cat's laying on me. All right, that's fine. And then rounding out the cast is Adam Williams as Woodward. This is his second and final Twilight Zone appearance. He previously played the sailor in the episode The Hitchhiker. And he also appeared in 1956's The Rack, which was written by Serling, which was about a dedicated Korean War hero inexplicably collaborating with the enemy while interred in a POW camp and is court-martialed because of it. I'd seen that just in my random searches of Serling and past episodes and stuff. I think it was a TV movie, is very interesting to me, and I hope to eventually cover it if I can find it. I don't believe it's on YouTube, but hopefully I can get my hands on it some in one way or another. Okay, and writer for this episode was Rod Serling, and he originally finished the first draft of the script back in April of 1959, originally having it written for season one. And CBS had given him a few notes, a few notes that he corrected and obliged them on. And then Robert Stevens was even slated to direct the episode in season one, but the script was eventually shelved and ultimately just revisited for season two, obviously. And let's see, a couple other things about it. There was originally a scene in the antique store, but since the studio was squeezing the production to save money at the time, he ended up cutting the scene, which I think was a smart choice because the newspaper insert and everything, that's an adequate way to bring us into the story, if only because it gives us more time with the characters that are going to be at the center of the story in a good way to establish them without having to do the whole backstory and everything of the antique store. And then finally, Serling had seen Gene Carson in a stage play and like had met her at a party and said that he had a role for her, referring to this role, of course, and that he would contact her. Of course, it was shelved after the notes and everything. So a while later, his agent called her when they were doing this script for season two. So that's nice that he kind of kept his word on that. And director for this episode was John Rich. This is his first of two episodes. Next is season five, and the episode was titled in season five for a Kind of Stopwatch, which, of course, I don't know anything about the Twilight Zone going forward after this point. So I kind of think it's funny that he directed two episodes. One is called A Most Unusual Camera and another is called A Kind of Stopwatch. So I kind of wonder if they have any kind of thematic elements that are tied together or any kind of, similarities other than the title. And I wonder if that's why John Rich was brought back for that, but we'll find that out in a long time when I get to season five. And John Rich is best known as the Emmy Award-winning director of All in the Family and The Dick Van Dyke Show. So that's a bit of interesting trivia. And now I'm going to go on to my feelings as a first-time viewer of this episode. What I knew before the episode was nothing. The title made me think of the Goosebumps book, Say Cheese and Die, and which the Goosebumps series was a seminal piece of literature from my childhood. And having seen this episode now, it's very clear that R.L. Stine was inspired by it for his Goosebumps book of Say Cheese and Die. Okay, so immediately this episode brings us into the perspective of the thieves of an antique shop. You know, I mentioned when I mentioned Serling writing the episode that it was originally going to open with a scene at the shop with the proprietors of the shop basically outlining what was missing and reporting the crime. And like I said a few minutes ago, I really liked this alternative just because it introduces us to the dynamic of Paula and Chester. Chester is obviously the husband and she's the wife. So we get a quick introduction to their dynamic and how they operate essentially. And it's immediately clear right from the outset that this is a, this is a very lighthearted, comedic focused episode of The Twilight Zone, which, you know, at the time that I watched this, it felt kind of welcome. It was, kind of a cheeky, fun, laid back episode. It wasn't, intense or it didn't make me nervous or anything. It was just kind of a fun ride. And then one other thing that I noticed kind of immediately was that the opening narration is kind of quick in this episode. Lately, we've been having several minutes of character interactions before getting introduced to Serling's narrations. But this comes pretty quick in the episode, and I kind of liked that. What I did really like about the narration itself was that the way that it was shot. So the opening narration, he's in the hotel room with Paula and Chester, and he's in front of a mirror, which shows them not sitting completely still, but just doing their own thing. Like, she's reading the newspaper, and I don't remember what Chester's doing. He's looking at the camera or looking at something, and they're just kind of stationary. And I kind of liked that because there was a little bit of an intrusive kind of feel to it. Serling was just commenting on the events that we're about to see, and while we can see that they are within earshot, and it was just kind of a cool, like, effective way to introduce the episode, having Serling tell us that this camera is gonna affect the lives of three people, and then we see two of the people just like there as he's saying it within earshot. It was a kind of a cool way to introduce the episode. It made me curious who the third person was going to be, which I will talk about, I'm sure. So, last thing about the opening narration is that I love the closing line where Serling says that pictures taken by this camera can only be developed in the Twilight Zone. I just liked that incorporation of the Twilight Zone into it, which is something he does every episode, and seems really clever to me. So I want to kind of single out Fred Clark's performance first in this opening scene, because he is kind of a huge delight in this episode. There's just something really magnetic about his performance. He is the kind of de facto leader of the group of thieves throughout the episode, and it's hard to describe because the episode itself is played for comedy and the thieves themselves are kind of buffoons, but Fred Clark's Chester, since he's the leader of the crew, he's kind of got this slight edge over the other two in the sense of intelligence and everything. He's still kind of buffoonish himself, but he has this kind of authoritative presence that he's like, his buffoonery overrides Paula's and the soon to be introduced Woodward's. And when they're looking at the camera and everything, first of all, I love just the casual reference of the foreign writing that's on the front. Because it's just a general remark that comes into play later in the episode and is actually of really big importance. And it just kind of, I like the way that it's just casually referenced to us. It's not a big deal. It's not a big mystery throughout the episode. It's just casually mentioned at the top. And, one thing that I did notice, millennial that I am, is that as soon as he takes the picture and then it develops and everything, I just thought, it's like a Polaroid. And then I wondered if the episode itself predated Polaroids. And I did a cursory Google search, and it looks like instant cameras like that were first developed in, I think, 1948, apparently. So it wasn't anything prescient that I could find. So that's fine. So Chester takes a picture of Paula standing by the window, which the window obviously comes into play a lot later in the episode, and windows themselves play a big role in the Twilight Zone itself overall. But one thing it just kind of bugged me about Jean Carson's performance is that it wasn't necessarily her performance, really. It was more the script. Chester takes a picture of her, and then the picture shows her in a fur coat. And, like, I don't know, it just rubbed me the wrong way that, like, it took so much to make Paula realize that she's wearing a big fur coat in the picture that she just took like 4 or 5 minutes ago. And I don't know. It was a little bit ridiculous to me. Like, Chester has her stand in front of the mirror and then look at it. And then it takes her like a few beats to really like realize, oh my God, I'm wearing a fur coat. I've never had a fur coat. It just kind of, I don't know. It stretched my suspension of disbelief just a little bit. And then Chester's kind of rationalization of what the photo is and what the camera is after that, it's really strong. And I think it's kind of in Fred Clark's performance, because he talks about how, like, he doesn't immediately think that it's anything supernatural. He just thinks, oh, it's a gag camera. They have pictures developed in it. When you take a photo, it just takes a photo of the head and then attaches it to it. And that's it. And I'm like, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. Like, that, I follow the logic really well in that. And, at that point, I kind of realized, like, the episode's kind of taking its time to develop the story here. And I liked it, because I kind of liked living in this world with these characters, as kind of silly and buffoonish as they are. They were kind of delightful a little bit. It was kind of fun just seeing them bicker back and forth. And so later that night in the hotel room, they are talking about it. They had the twin beds that I've referenced before. And Paula is asking him why he hasn't gone to bed. And he's just kind of fascinated by the camera. And then that's the introduction of Woodward, is that they take a photo of the door, and then her brother, who is incarcerated, shows up within 5 minutes. And right before that, Chester kind of comes to terms with it and says that it could be the work of witches or black magic or sorcery or anything. And then Paula says, like, where's the man with the horns who comes with a bargain for the soul? And I liked that, because that kind of subverts our expectations, or maybe not subverts our expectations, but kind of plays with what we've seen in the Twilight Zone before, and what's kind of maybe not at this point, but overall it's kind of tropish in general, like, oh, the deal with the devil kind of thing. So I like that it calls attention to that and shows us that it's not going to be that type of story. And I like that Chester's suggestions about what it could be, that's all the backstory we get on the camera, and that's all that we need. Because he says that it could be the work of witches or black magic, and I like that those possible explanations are just adding kind of color to the episode while also giving us nothing about the actual background of the camera. I like that. I like that we didn't get any information, but we have these ideas that are suggested in a kind of somewhat silly and entertaining way. And so we get introduced to Woodward, which I'm just going to come out and say it. I really enjoyed Adam Williams's performance in The Hitchhiker a lot more than in this one, because while they are all kind of buffoons and everything, Woodward is just a little too dopey and dumb for me. Like, at the act break, when he comes in and he sees the picture, he's kind of, there's like this tone to his voice that's kind of like, oh, geez, yeah, I'll watch TV. It's a little too, like, it's a little distracting for me. And like, when he sees the picture, he's kind of has this just blank expression on his face, and he's like, what, how come? And it's just like, I don't know. I just don't know. It just rubbed me the wrong way. And he's kind of treated as kind of like a child. Like, later in the episode, when Paula asks him if he's done with a snack, he's like, yeah, that'll hold me over till dinner. And then earlier than that, when Chester asks him if he wants to see something on TV, he's kind of a childlike presence, and I don't know, it kind of didn't work for me in a comedic way. And so we're brought into the second act, and they're kind of debating on how they can use the camera, and I like that, because at that point in my first viewing, I had no idea how they could use it to their advantage. I hadn't thought of the horse races. And the reason is that when I was watching this episode, all I was thinking of was, like, how can they use this to their advantage if the picture is only 5 minutes in the future? Because that's such a finite amount of time that I didn't know how they could use it to their advantage. And I kind of really was charmed by Chester's his whole thing about wanting to turn the camera over to science and use it to pay back humanity and give it as a gift for humanity and everything. And I love the way that the script plays with that, because you have Paula saying, like, what's humanity ever done for us? And then he's still, like, he's telling her, like, well, imagine what medical science can do with this, which, honestly, I mean, it's a camera that takes a picture 5 minutes of what's going to come in 5 minutes in the future. I have no idea how medical science could use that to their advantage in any way. I really don't. If you have any idea of how, like, medical science and the scientific community could use the camera's power to their advantage, let me know, because I'm very curious. I guess the test results of different scientific experiments, I guess. So that cuts down on that, but I don't know. It just seemed kind of silly. But I mean, I get it. Like, you know, turn it over to science so they can reverse engineer it or look into it. Yeah, obviously. But just the idea of a bunch of scientists like, well, I don't know what the hell to do with this, is just kind of funny to me. But anyway, so I like that Chester has this whole noble thing with it, and then as soon as he sees the horse race on TV, he's like, oh no, wait, let's use this to cheat, and let's use this for money, our own personal gain. And I love that. And then when they're getting ready to leave, and like Chester's telling Woodward, like, go get one of my shirts and then make sure you wear a tie. And then as he walks off the screen, Chester's putting on the jacket, and then he's like, wait, how much money do we have? And then they're kind of going through their money. And then again, this other line just kind of bugged me, where he's like, all right, 10, I have 30, and I have 20. And then, Paula has 10. And then he's like, okay, that's 30. And then she's like, I know it's 30. It's like that seemed a little too, like it was trying a little too hard to be cute. But anyway, I was really feeling the comedic, energy of the episode as they're kind of bustling out the door. And then Paula's like, wait, Chuck, what about humanity? Or I think maybe Woodward says that. And then he says, I love the kind of, callback to a few minutes earlier when, Chester's just like, humanity, what did humanity ever do for us? I love that. Like, that sequence kind of almost felt like it could have been kind of a backdoor pilot for another series. I mean, obviously, given the ending of the episode, there's no way that this could have been, but I would have liked to see more stories with these two or these three characters, even though I wasn't too fond of Woodward as a character, like, and Gene Carson's performance. I kind of like, they have such a fun energy to them and a good sense of comedic timing that I feel like they could have worked well together in a series, like an episode to episode kind of thing in their own standalone series. It's a shame we didn't get that. I don't know if that was ever any, I doubt that it was in anything that would be suggested or anything, but in another universe, I think it could have been kind of fun to see them play with more hijinks and everything. So they go to the racetrack and they they end up with a ton of money. Like, I was kind of super jealous, but like after the first race, when Chester comes back and he's like, we have $9,500. All I thought was, man, $9,500 in 1960. That's unreal. Like, I like, that is, I didn't check to see how much it would be like in today's money, but man, $9,500 in 1960. That's insane. And my next note was, I want this camera so much. And then after they get back to the hotel and the waiter comes in, couple things about that. One is, I love how stupid they are, because they are just openly counting all the money. Like, I immediately thought, like, man, at least make an effort to hide your winnings and everything and hide your money. And I was so delighted that it came back to play in a couple scenes later. But I really liked the reveal that there was only 10 pictures to an owner on the camera. And, like, that was such an interesting wrinkle so late in the episode. And like, it made me like mentally think, like, I wonder how many pictures they've taken. And when they deduced that they've taken six picture or eight pictures and they only have two left, I loved that because it shifts the episode a little bit. And I also like that the way that they're arguing and passing the camera back and forth, they accidentally take the ninth picture. It made me think that she was going to die. So I was pretty surprised when they both fell out the window and it was Chester and Woodward that ended up dying. And, and then this was the part where Jean Carson kind of shined for me. Because she's immediately like, oh, I'm so sad. Like I have nothing to live for and everything. And now my brother and my husband are both dead. And then she's like kind of taking the money and she's like, well, you know, live on, move on. Let's just move on. And, you know, we have to move on with our lives and everything. I love that quick turn there. And then, so I thought it was kind of weird that she took a picture of the bodies on the ground. Like she used the last picture on the camera to take a picture of her dead husband and dead brother. She says it's for posterity. And all I thought was, you were just arguing that you should save the last two pictures at the time for a rainy day. And then now you're suddenly just taking a picture of dead bodies. Like it didn't compute to me. And, it felt so much like the plot needed it. And it, I mean, the plot did need it, but it kind of felt a little bit silly, that she would just immediately waste the last picture on something that was nothing for her personal gain. It was just strictly plot necessitated. And so then the waiter comes back in and I didn't look up who he is or where he's from or anything, but I mean, the accent was fine. I didn't think he did a bad job with it or anything. The script does have him say a couple of times, he says, how you say, which just feels like such a classic kind of like foreign character with broken English that it kind of seems like a script writing crutch a little bit. But that's just, it wasn't anything that detracted from the episode. It's just something that, went off in my mind. So the finale of the episode is that the waiter is stealing the money and he's kind of gotten the upper hand over the thieves and everything. He's looked into them. They're all wanted. Chester and Woodward have both died. So he's just like, yeah, I'm here to steal your money. And I love the confidence and cockiness of him in that scene. And, but the ending, she falls out the window after he tells her that, there are more than two bodies in the photo. And like, that was okay. I like that. She trips over the cord and falls out the window when she goes to look. And I liked that. I thought that was cool. But then the waiter follows. He looks at the picture and it's kind of similar to Paulo with the fur coat earlier in the episode. Like he looks at the picture and he's like, wait, one, two, three, there's four bodies. And then he drops the camera and then the film camera like points at the most unusual camera and you hear him fall out the window. It doesn't make, I don't know how he fell out. Like, I don't know what caused him to fall out the window or anything. It just felt like, it was like, this is how we should end the episode. So that kind of, like, it could have been, I would have liked to have seen like the last picture, like instead of being told what it was, maybe the last scene of the movie or last scene of the episode would have been just a still frame of the picture. And then maybe have a more interesting or more connected way to, what's the word I'm looking for? A more logical way for him to die. But I don't know. It was a fun episode, though. And so, yeah, so overall, I thought that A Most Unusual Camera was a fun, like, lighthearted episode. I kind of equate it to Mr. Beavis, but good. Mr. Beavis was another lighthearted episode that didn't really connect that well. And then this episode had its faults, but I think it rested on the or relied on the chemistry of the main characters and the energy, particularly of Fred Clark's performance, because he was outstanding. And I just liked the hijinks of this better. So it similar in style and similar in tone to Mr. Beavis, but much better executed in my opinion, even though it has its own faults with the ending and some of the kind of plot convenient character moments sprinkled in here and there. But overall, it was a fun episode, and I don't think it'll make my top 10 list or anything for episodes from season 2 or anything like that, but it wasn't a chore to rewatch it. It was a fun episode that I enjoyed. And so I don't really have much trivia for this episode, or really any trivia for this episode, aside from what I've already said in the cast and crew breakdown and everything. Like I said, R.L. Stine took inspiration for the plot of the novel Say Cheese and Die from the Goosebumps series for this. And I know Say Cheese and Die was one of the popular Goosebumps books. There was a few sequels to it, I believe. And it was one of the stories that was adapted for the Goosebumps TV series. And then also there was an episode of Futurama called The Thief of Baghead that references this episode. There's a great shirt on TeePublic that's the doorway logo for the Twilight Zone, and it just says The Scary Door, which is the name of the Twilight Zone show in Futurama. I really want to get that shirt, but anyway, in the episode The Thief of Baghead, Bender owns a camera that he refers to as his Twilight Zone lens that takes photographs 1 minute into the future. So I haven't gotten to that episode yet, but of Futurama, but I'm slowly working my way through Futurama. Eventually I'll get through all of it. So that's my review of A Most Unusual Camera. And of course, before we move on to this week's bonus review, I'm going to play a little highlight from a recent episode of Tower Junkies, which is a podcast discussing Stephen King and the Dark Tower series. I host over at obsessiveviewer.com and at towerjunkiespod.com. It was kind of haunting to read it now, knowing that in 1999, Stephen King was himself hit by a car. So that was kind of an interesting, it made for kind of a chilling read. You can find Tower Junkies Pod on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at towerjunkiespod.com. And you can find all of my podcasting at obsessiveviewer.com/podcasts. All right. And this week's bonus review is the 2014 sci-fi independent movie Time Lapse, which was directed by Bradley King and written by Bradley King and co-written by B.P. Cooper. And it stars Danielle Panabaker, Matt O'Leary, and George Finn. I watched this movie after renting it on the Google Play Store. So it's not available to stream anywhere. I believe at one time it was streaming on Amazon Prime, so maybe it'll go back onto Amazon Prime, but it was well worth the $3 rental. I enjoyed it quite a bit. The IMDb summary is: three friends discover a mysterious machine that takes pictures 24 hours into the future and conspire to use it for personal gain until disturbing and dangerous images begin to develop. So it is a very similar plot to A Most Unusual Camera. There's three main characters. There's a camera that takes photographs in the future, and they use that for personal gain. There are some very big differences, though. The camera takes pictures 24 hours in advance, and the camera itself is a giant machine that's in their neighbor's apartment that has just a view of their living room. So that's the only way that the camera kind of automatically takes the photos. So it's a very interesting change or a very interesting wrinkle to the story. It's a stationary device that automatically takes a photograph every 24 hours of one location. And what I liked about that is that there are a lot of times where the characters kind of have to replicate what the photo is. Eventually it comes to a point where they are kind of, at the mercy of it. They kind of feel compelled to, like, okay, well, they now have knowledge that in 24 hours, the three of them are going to be sitting on the couch. So in 24 hours, they have to be sitting on the couch. And that alone is a very interesting, that's what makes this type of story very interesting to me and fascinating. Cause it's this question of, okay, we as humans have free will. We have free will to do whatever we want. But when we are at the mercy of something that takes away that free will, that's when we, like, it's interesting to see how characters interact and how characters react to situations like that. And the photographs that are taken in this movie, they kind of escalate from the first to the last. And there's some really clever, like, wrinkles to it that I was very much, impressed with how it worked out. The movie itself kind of reminded me a little bit of another kind of independent, time travel movie, Primer, which is a movie that I need to see again. That it's a very kind of, my memory of it is that it's a very convoluted, mind trippy kind of movie, but, Time Lapse is a much more straightforward story, and the cleverness is it's still a clever time travel story, but it's not anything that makes your head like throb with a headache about trying to figure out what it is. So when I was watching this is almost immediately after first seeing A Most Unusual Camera, all I thought was, okay, hypothetically, if you are given this power, this device where you can see a photograph can be taken 24 hours in advance and you have control over that, why wouldn't you use that for personal gain? Like, who on the planet would not use that to benefit? Like, I mean, I would in a heartbeat. Honestly, like, just the thought of, like, okay, all my bills could be paid for a year if I just put a newspaper clipping on the window of my apartment. Like, yeah, I'm going to do that 100%. So the three characters are, there's Finn. He's an aspiring painter, and he's kind of the manager of the entire kind of property. He's a property manager, so he has to go. There's actually a really great scene at the beginning where he is one of the tenants calls him to unclog her toilet. And this is after it's established that he is, he's a struggling artist. Like, he has this creative block where he can't paint anything. And so when he is unclogging this toilet, after having this tense session where he's trying to paint but can't, like, the creative juices aren't flowing, as he's unclogging the toilet, the tenant is talking about, like, how, like, oh yeah, my nephew or something wants to be a painter, and I told him, oh yeah, my maintenance man used to be a painter or something. It's just like, that is just painful. Like, that's a really great scene in the movie. So that's Finn. He's one of the main characters. And then his girlfriend is, Callie, played by Danielle Panabaker. And she's kind of an aspiring writer, from the sound of it, or not from the sound of it. I've seen the movie, I promise. She's an aspiring, writer, and she is, I don't want to say like mother hen to the trio or anything, cause they all live in the same apartment, but she is kind of, I don't know. She's the girlfriend of Finn. I'll say that, cause there's some stuff I could say that could go into spoilers, but, I won't, obviously. And then finally rounding out the cast is, the character of, Jasper, played by George Finn. And he is this kind of, sleazy, kind of like semi drug pusher gambling guy. Like he has kind of a gambling problem. So then he's kind of the crux for using the camera for personal gain. And yeah, so that's kind of the setup, and I won't go into too much detail, but the movie, I really enjoyed the pacing of it, because it's immediately established like what the camera does and what the camera can do and how they need to react to it. And there, it's immediately kind of there's a very immediate and clear indication of why they need to be in each picture. So they become kind of trapped by it and wrapped up in it. And it becomes this thing where they need to make sure that they get into place for the picture and everything. And it's just that alone is a very interesting concept to me. And then some of the photos are just like kind of mind-boggling and kind of a screw head screwy kind of thing. And I just really like the way that it's the way that the plot unfolds. And then there are, of course, kind of some other dramatic things that come up. Like there's some stuff with Jasper's bookie and a henchman and everything, and the whole fact that they need to keep this secret and everything. The whole movie comes together in a really unique and really satisfying way. Because if you're a fan of time travel movies, you kind of know that they need to kind of come together in a way that makes logical sense within the confines and constraints of the rules of the time travel in the movie. And while some of the elements of this movie, some of the rules are kind of amended here and there, but it's still a really satisfying time travel movie and a really fun or a really impressive time travel movie, considering this it's just a small independent movie. And it's really, really cool how they do that, how the movie was made with limited sets, limited actors, and just pure cleverness of screenwriting and everything. So if you're a fan of time travel, if you're a fan of the Most Unusual Camera, I think you'll get a lot out of Time Lapse. Like I said, it's available on Google Play. I'm sure you can rent it on iTunes or Amazon or anywhere else you rent movies. And yeah, so that's my review of Time Lapse, and that's episode 43 of Anthology. Hope you enjoyed it. If you like what you've heard and you want to help support the show, the easiest way to do that is by leaving a rating and review on iTunes. We still have a couple weeks left of the promotion for a free Anthology shirt, so just take a picture or take a screenshot of the iTunes review, send it to me in an email at matt@obsessiveviewer.com, and you'll be entered into win a free Anthology t-shirt. And you can also donate to the podcast through PayPal by clicking the donate button on anthologypod.com, or you can do recurring donations through Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. And Patreon just recently changed their payout way. It's kind of very anger inducing, because essentially now they're putting service charges on the patrons so that the creators can get a more steady income and everything, which I think is kind of crappy of them to do. So, so like right now, Robert has a $10 patronage with me or whatever. He backs me for $10 a month. So now his card is going to be charged $10 and some odd cents because the service charge is going to fall on him. I think that's pretty shady. So if you are interested in being a patron and that's turning you away, feel free to just do that through PayPal, and just send the money directly to me on PayPal and, using the link on the website. And, if you want to use it for a reward tier for the month on Patreon, just send me a message or anything. And Robert, for you as well, I'll email you as well. But if you want to use PayPal instead, I don't know how PayPal works with the service charges and everything, but I know that I get the, I don't know. We'll figure it out. So anyway, that's all that. That's this week's episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. Next week, I'm super excited because next week I'm reviewing The Night of the Meek, which is the 11th episode of the Twilight Zone second season. And the bonus review is going to be the remake of The Night of the Meek, titled just Night of the Meek, from the 1985 revival of the Twilight Zone. And I'm really excited for that because I started this podcast a couple years ago, and I've had a lot of kind of gaps in releasing and everything, and some stretches where I didn't. And somehow, through the grace of just pure coincidence, I have managed to reach the Twilight Zone's one and only like official Christmas episode, and I am in line to release it a week before Christmas, and I think that that's kind of cool. So I'm excited to talk about the Night of the Meek next week, and then before you know it, we're going to be reviewing Black Mirror and Electric Dreams and whatever other science fiction anthology shows come up, which we're kind of in a sci-fi anthology renaissance sort of thing, which is very welcome, but it's going to do wonders for my vocal cords. So yeah, without further ado, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For more of Anthology and a full archive of my episodes, go to anthologypod.com. And if you want to help support the show, the easiest way you can do that is by leaving a rating and a review on iTunes. You can also make donations to the show courtesy of the donate link in the show notes of each episode and on anthologypod.com. For recurring donations, you can become a patron at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and just choose one of the Anthology reward tiers. If you enjoy Anthology, feel free to check out The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast I host with my friend Tiny and occasional guest co-hosts over at ObsessiveViewer.com. You can also join The Obsessive Viewer Facebook group at facebook.com/TheObsessiveViewer. For book reviews and commentary on the world of reading, check out our sister site at ObsessiveBookNerd.com. And for philosophical discussions from a secular viewpoint, check out my friends Chad and Amanda at TheSecularPerspective.com. Finally, if you'd like to contact me with your thoughts on the show, my reviews, my bonus reviews, or for any other reason, you can tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, send me an email at Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com, or send me a message on Facebook and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. Once again, thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.